is going to talk to us about what we might be able to do using these scaffolds, I think, I hope.
Yeah.
Francis, do you want me to talk for a bit while you're plugging that in?
No. I was just thinking it's a marvellous bit of multidisciplinary teamwork that you've had four speakers
and
with three different Apple Macs, and which is very impressive. And I'm sure we'll be changing formats shortly as well, just to do that. So I'd like to firstly say what a pleasure it is to be here. Thank you very much, Ian, for inviting me. It's fantastic to be able to get all these kind of different concepts together. Tough order to talk about this huge topic of tissue engineering and explain what it's about, pick up some of the key things about it in 15 minutes. So if you're in the field and you think I've completely neglected everything that you're interested in, I apologize enormously. You'll understand that I just want to pick on a few things that I think are particularly relevant to this afternoon. Really, I think probably stem cells is the wrong idea. What we're really talking about here, and I think Andrew showed it really beautifully, is the concept of tissue engineering. And tissue engineering is a range of skills, a very multidisciplinary discipline, whereby we are looking at the application of a range of skills such as the cells, the bioactive molecules. Now, I think this is something that we kind of neglect, that when you have a cell only does what it's told to do, and actually understanding how you tell a cell what to do is one of the key issues in all of this process. And as we've already seen, the biomaterials. I confess I'm not a material scientist at all. I'm not going to say very much about the materials, but I think Andrew's really given you a very nice taster of that. So the idea of this is to be able to regenerate tissues, organs, etc., etc. And in regards to the sort of facial surgery aspect, you could consider this to be a new type of plastic surgery. So can we harness these different problems about cells and about the molecules that control them and the materials that you could use to put them all together for example, regrow a face for reconstruction? And I think you've got a very nice taster of, for example, how one might develop bones, for example, that as we've seen, and the potential benefits of being able to do that. So as a general principle, tissue formation, both physiologically, normally in the body, and therapeutically, if you want to do this as a treatment, then firstly, you need the correct cells. And there are lots of different cells in molecular cell biology, the classic textbook. I think there are 116 different cell phenotypes listed in the body. And these come from these famous stem cells. And we'll obviously say more about stem cells in a moment. The second thing you need, as I've emphasized, are the correct signals to control them, things called growth factors and other signaling molecules. And then finally, in this regard for tissue engineering, you need the correct tissue form and environment, and clearly that's particularly important in this area. And in relation to this topic, we're looking particularly at artificial materials. Now, stem cells effectively come as two types, if you like, and it's a bit artificial to divide them this way. There are the so-called pluripotent embryonic stem cells, and these are stem cells derived from an embryo which have the capacity to give rise to all of the different cell types in the body. Clearly, there has been a lot of ethical discussion about the use of embryonic stem cells, particularly because of the nature of how they're derived. But there are obviously other ethical issues in relation to that. I'm particularly talking about adult stem cells. We all have stem cells in our body. If we didn't, then our tissues would very quickly become worn out, because your cells have a finite lifespan and have to be replaced by new cells all the time. So you have a store of stem cells. Even as you get older, you continue to have stem cells that will give rise to a range of different tissues. These tend to have a more restricted potential, but they're often what we call multipotent. So you take a stem cell and it can still give rise to, for example, all of the different cell types that you find in the blood, for example. And these persist throughout life. So, for example, if you take bone marrow stromal cells, or these are like the fibrous little cells that are present in bone marrow. You can enrich them for the stem cells in there, and you put them in a dish. They look fairly unimpressive in a dish. And in the right circumstances and the right stimuli, you can get them to do all sorts of interesting things, even in a tissue culture dish in the laboratory. The easiest thing for them to do, if you like, their default thing, is to form fibrous tissue, a tissue that we neglect enormously. We almost forget how important it is, and particularly for structure and form and things. It's a terribly important tissue. You can get them to form myoblasts, which are muscle cells. So from those cultures that I've shown you, you can actually form this in a dish. These are muscles that will twitch away even in a dish, which is quite fun. But without very much manipulation, you can get muscle cells. You can get fat cells. And you can also get cartilage, which is quite a nice thought as you get older and my knees are going. That's a really nice bit of cartilage, an unusually nice bit of cartilage to grow in a dish, I must say. I say so myself. And also, you can get bone as well. And bone doesn't look that exciting in a dish, actually. It looks a bit like that. I can tell you it's bone, it's mineralized, it has all the features of bone. It doesn't look the most exciting one, but it's the one that I kind of happen to know the most about. So in my kind of illustration of stem cells, I'm particularly concentrating on bone. Now, as you can see, this cell has the capacity to do all sorts of things, so it needs to know what it has to do and where it has to do it. And to do that, for example, if you take a stem cell, then just looking at it becoming a bone cell, then there are a series of molecules that work in a coordinated way to stimulate it from stem cell through to osteoblast, which is a bone-forming cell. And there's quite a complex array of different molecules. The ones that are probably most important here are the ones at this end that work directly on the stem cells because they're instructive to the stem cells. I'm going to say a little bit about a group of molecules called BMPs, but there's a very interesting group of molecules called WNTs, which are a rather complex group of signaling molecules, which are also desperately important at this sort of end of the process. So if you take this molecule, for example, and you stick it on a stem cell, you'll remember it can become all these different tissues, then effectively what happens is that you can form bone, which is quite nice. It would direct it in that way. And so consequently, this has great therapeutic potential as a bone-forming molecule. And as an illustration of that, you can see this is an animal experiment done by a Dutch group where they removed this bone here, and basically 15 weeks later it doesn't heal. Because you can't put the two bits of the bone together, it doesn't heal. Whereas if you put BMP in there, you don't need to put stem cells in there, you put BMP in there and you can see it heals beautifully. And the reason you don't need to put stem cells in there is that the BMP is signaling to the body's own stem cells to do that. So the signaling molecules are important, as are the stem cells that you might want to grow into a scaffold. And whilst I've talked mainly about bone here, you can also grow skin in the laboratory, and this is already being done for skin grafting. These are epithelial cells. And interestingly, again, you can't just grow them and they'll form skin. They need the right sort of environment to form skin. And the way you do that in the laboratory is you grow them on a sort of artificial connective tissue, which is basically collagen with some fibroblasts in it. And you can see that in fact, the cultured one looks nicer than the normal skin here, doesn't it? And that's what it looks like. This is laboratory epithelium that you can actually use as skin grafts as well. So we can actually grow and direct cells to form a range of different tissues. Putting them together to do the next stage is the next challenge, if you like. And the biomaterials bit comes into this now. We need to provide a 3D structure, as we've seen, the scaffold for tissue formation. You can actually manipulate the materials in a range of different ways to help get the right type of tissue. For example, you can use it to release the right signaling molecules. You can use it so that it's the right shape to get vessels growing into it. And ideally, you want this scaffold, once it's implanted, to resorb so it disappears, allowing blood vessels, etc., to go in. So where are we now? We can readily isolate and expand patients, many of the patient's stem cells in a laboratory, and we can stimulate them to make different tissues. We can reconstitute them in 3D form, and this is perhaps, you know, the area where tissue engineering is at its sort of exponential growth at the moment. And people have started to use these things and have actually reimplanted tissue, particularly a couple of groups who have grown fashioned bones in the way that Andrew was aspiring to. And actually what they did is they put them with a BMP plus a scaffold plus the cells, and then they reimplanted them after actually burying them for a time to become vascularized. And it's not clear whether it was the stem cells or just the BMPs or what it was that actually made it work. But this is almost a reality in that two groups have done it. So we've seen that this building out from the skull outwards is going to be a key issue in all of this, and the ability to plan this you've heard in much more detail than I can give you now. But there are some real major challenges for this type of approach. And particularly, I've shown you, you could make blocks of bone or blocks of connective tissue and blocks of epithelium and probably blocks of muscle. But actually, those things need to work together. They need to be vascularized, which is the most important thing, getting the blood vessels in there. And with the complex array of facial muscles, you need to be able to, in the long term, to be able to offer prospects for neural control of those tissues as well. So sensation plus movement. And those things are quite a challenge. But if we look a little bit further ahead, then we have to think perhaps and be even more optimistic than the ability to potentially plan more shapes. And if anything is important in the facial region, as we've heard, shape is going to be incredibly important. And so far, when I've talked about bone, I've talked about bone. I've shown you cells and I said this is a slab of bone. But actually, this is a mouse embryo. And bone isn't just bone, is it? It's an amazingly complex array, beautifully formed, perfectly formed in a very, very complex sort of way. So the question really is, are all these bones the same? And if so, how do they know in an embryo how to form what shapes? This doesn't obviously apply only to bone, but the only evidence I've got is in bone, so I'll give you that. And what we know is that if you look at a cell at any particular place, it's told where to go, and effectively it has a molecular address. So the address for a bone cell that's here will be different from a bone cell that's here. And there are a series of genes, which the developmental biologists understand rather well, which are switched on, and the further back you go, the different ones, so the red ones are switched on here, and as you go further back, you get the purple ones and the yellow ones and the green ones. And the further back you go, the higher the number is. And these are called homeobox genes. So in the embryo, cells have a molecular address. And ultimately, the molecular address is what gives you your shape. And because we're all genetically subtly different, although the address will be quite similar for all of us, we will all have a slightly different address, which is quite an interesting thought, I think. Now, we sort of assume that once the tissues are formed, that address kind of doesn't mean anything anymore. Actually, in our lab recently, we've discovered that some of these address genes persist in adult tissues. So we've looked at adult bone cells, and they all have a distinctive molecular address still in adult tissues, in the pretty much the same pattern as the embryonic tissues. So if you take a bone cell from the skull, not from the embryo, but from the skull, it doesn't have any of these particular address genes. If you take one from the leg, which is down here, you get the higher number Hox genes, and in the arm a different combination. Very exciting. Obviously, if you're taking stem cells from one place and growing them up, and you know the address of where you want them to go, then in the future it may well be incredibly exciting to be able to give them their new address. And you transfect in the genes that say, this is your new address, go away and do your stuff. So this is very speculative. We haven't published this yet. It's about data that we pulled out a couple of weeks ago. But I thought it was extremely relevant today because Ian said, you know, be blue skies, just make it up as you go along, you know. No, he didn't really say that at all. Anyway. So in the future, we may be able to accurately program cells to say, I don't just want you to make bone, I want you to make a cheekbone. And the overlying skin or whatever will know because that's what we've told it to do. So the process overall, and in summary, one of the great things about this compared with some of the conventional techniques, particularly for cell implantation and also in facial transplants, is that we're talking about autologous cells. The patient's own cells, there's no tissue rejection, and potentially, because of the sort of technology that you've heard Andrew talk about, we potentially have better control over the outcomes, such as appearance, than we do today. But certainly this is an aspiration rather than the reality. Little dips of the toe into the swimming pool are encouraging, but we're still some way away from really saying, right, we're going to reconstruct this patient's face through a series of tissue engineering steps. And I think also, for the foreseeable future, this isn't a one-stage procedure. This is a lengthy process involving one stage after another after another, and some particular technical challenges. But it certainly looks, in this field, as in a number of other fields, that the prize is well worth following for now. So thank you very much.
Francis, I thought that was fantastic. I think that's exactly what I wanted. I think I like the address concept. And thank you for sharing that most recent work. I mean, that's really... So you're here... The few of you that are here, you're here at the start of something really big. You've just heard something that nobody else outside Queen Mary and Westfield has heard as yet. And I think that that's what I wanted to talk about today. The public, the media...